wonderful parameter institute. And especially grateful for this opportunity to go back to my first love in the foundations of physics, the uncertainty relations, on which I have been working for my PhD project in the 80s. And although it's a bit long time ago, I still want to tell you something about what we learned there. And in particular, also, I want to take the opportunity to present some insights of my old supervisor, Jan Hilgevoort, who has been considering the time energy uncertainty relation and the status of time in quantum mechanics much more deeply than I have. And I hope to be able to present some of these insights. Here is very briefly a sort of outline for the talk. I will first consider Heisenberg's original uncertainty paper. Then I will point out some problems for the time-energy uncertainty relation, in particular for the commutation relation between a time and energy observable. I will pose some questions. I will take a brief look at classical mechanics and how time appears there, and in particular go into the distinction between the status of dynamical variables and space-time coordinates. I will briefly consider three options of deriving or constructing a time observable and corresponding time energy uncertainty relations. And then I will also have some conclusions, if time permits. So here's Heisenberg's original uncertainty paper. As you might well know, is there a laser pointer? He introduced in that paper an uncertainty relation for position and momentum in the form P1 or Q1. P1 is of the order of magnitude of Planck's constant, where the P1 and Q1 stand for uncertainties in position and momentum, although Heisenberg at that time did not specify any precise definition for these uncertainties. But he did argue that this uncertainty relation was most intimately connected to a commutation relation. Nothing here. And indeed, that was, of course, vindicated very soon when Kennard and Robertson later presented a formal version of the uncertainty relation. And in particular, Robertson's work is well known because, is there chalk? Because Robertson derived the relation that for any two quantum observables, there is a lower bound, thank you, for their uncertainties in terms of the commutator of the two observables, where now the capital deltas represent exactly defined uncertainties in terms of the root mean squares of the associated probability distributions. So indeed, there was a very close connection between uncertainty relations and commutation relations. And Heisenberg indeed claimed that in the uncertainty relations, we see an expression of the non-commuting properties of quantum observables. In the same paper, he immediately generalized his findings to time and energy and wrote down similar uncertainty relation for time and energy. Which button is it? The center. Okay, so, yeah. And Heisenberg claimed that this was likewise connected to a commutation relation for time and energy, which he called a familiar commutation relation. And he presented it, well, in this form. And there was actually some obscurity in this paper because, well, of course, the word or, both in German and English, can stand for two things, that he was summing up two alternative cases, two distinct uncertainty relations between which you could choose. But it could also mean that he was trying to say that these were sort of synonymous, that this relation, or in other words, this relation was the commutation relation in question. I will get back to that possibility later. Let's first concentrate on this time-energy commutation rule, which Heisenberg apparently thought was familiar, but actually it soon turned out to be fraught with difficulties. In fact, this was even known before Heisenberg wrote his paper. There is an earlier paper by London and a similar paper by Jordan, where they pointed out that there are problems with commutation relations for observables with bounded spectra. And these problems can be summarized in a nice little theorem. It was famously pointed out by Pauli in his encyclopedia article. A more generalized version of the theorem was given by Alcock. It's also mentioned by Harvey Brown. And there is an even more generalized version by Unruh and Wald from the 1980s. But here's sort of the gist of the whole matter. Assume that the Hamiltonian, as usual, is bounded from below. And let us consider any putative time operator, which presumably will have a class of eigenstates, which may be improper. But let's impose the condition that if you evolve the state over time, then that would merely present a shift in the probability distributions over the various values of the time. Then one can immediately show that these states cannot be orthogonal, and therefore they cannot be eigenstates of any self-adjoint operator. So there is no self-adjoint operator T that can stand in a commutation relation with the Hamiltonian like that. In other words, this version of the time-energy uncertainty relation fails, and this non-existence of a proper operator for time is often seen to be an essential weakness of quantum theory. And here's a famous quotation from von Neumann's well-known book, in which he says that, well, the chief weakness of quantum mechanics is its non-relativistic character, which distinguishes time from the space coordinates x, y, and z. And he spells out that distinction by saying that these spatial coordinates are represented by operators in quantum theory, whereas time does not correspond to an operator, but remains a classical number, a C number, as Dirac would put it. I will try to show you that there is a major confusion in this statement, but we will get to that later. Of course, given the fact that time is apparently not represented by a self-adjoint operator in quantum mechanics, leaves us with a problem, perhaps precisely because the time-energy uncertainty relation on the pragmatic level seems to be very useful. And there are many instances of sound reasoning. Bill has shown us an example of Bohr's analysis of the photon box, And there are many other instances in which a pragmatic version of a time-energy uncertainty relation seems to be valid or true. And yet we cannot express it in the same scheme as we can for the position and momentum observable. So people have tried to look at alternatives, some of them good, some of them not so good. Here is just a couple of examples. The first two statements are both due, in a sense, to Landau, in which he claimed that energy cannot be measured in a short time. And again, Bill Unruh has already pointed out that this just has no place in quantum mechanics, because in the orthodox formulation, we assume that any observable, including energy, can be measured in an instant. And a second formulation of Landau's formulation can be found in his famous textbook with Lifshitz. And you often hear versions of this statement that, that an uncertainty relation between energy and time would somehow mean that you can violate energy conservation if only you do it in a very short period. And both of these statements are wrong. As you can see from the textbook that Landau-Lifshitz wrote, and also the original paper by Landau and Peierls, all of this is really due to the fact that the authors are considering a first-order perturbation theory, and the results they obtain are also due to this perturbation theory, and they don't generalize to the exact theory. I mean, in quantum mechanics, energy is strictly conserved, and the only apparent violation of the energy is due to the fact that you have an unperturbed energy and you have a perturbed energy, and the two don't commute, so that the violation of the total energy is not the same thing as violation as conservation of the perturbed energy. Then there is another approach, which you also find mentioned in many textbooks, a relation that's due to Mandelstam and Tam from 1945, where they found a relation of this form. It's topographically similar to an uncertainty relation between the Hamiltonian and some time. But this time is defined like this. It's roughly the rate by which the expectation of some observable varies divided by its own uncertainty. So it's the time you need to evolve a system such that the expectation of A becomes appreciably different from what it was originally given the width of its distribution. So the time you need to change this value more than this value. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. Which is nice, because at least in this case, we are dealing with an exact theorem. But as many people have pointed out, it seems to be somewhat unsatisfactory as an uncertainty relation, precisely because this definition of tau, well, it's not of the same form as the other uncertainties. In fact, it isn't an uncertainty. It's just the time you need to have this expectation value change by a given amount. So it seems to be a rather different type of object than the other uncertainty relations. Now, here are the questions that I hope to pose in some more detail. As we have seen from the quote by von Neumann, there seems to be a feeling in the literature that time should be an observable in order from the requirements of relativity theory. In a sense, that, of course, is a strange requirement, because orthodox quantum theory simply isn't a relativistic theory. So why should you import requirements from that other theory? On the other hand, of course, one can see this as a desire to extend non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And in order to make progress in that direction, one would simply have to put them in a sort of similar status, which means that time and position must stand on the same footing. And then it's strange that time would not have an operator, whereas position does. Another question is, of course, well, we have seen the restrictions posed by this Pauli-Alcock theorem. But there are, of course, around for every theorem, there are ways to get around it. And so the next question is it really impossible to find an observable for time? And the main question I will actually try to argue for in terms of a solution of the problem is the question, do we really need quantum commutation relations in order to have an adequate uncertainty principle? But before I go into that, I want to take a look at classical Hamiltonian mechanics for point particles and see how time gets represented in that case. Now, as you presumably all know, in that theory, we are dealing with a state of a general system which is part of some phase space. We assume that there is a Hamiltonian given on that phase space, which may, in general, be time dependent. And there are equations of motion for every function on that state space, where the P and the Q denote all these observables collectively. And these equations of motion are given in terms of the Poisson brackets. Well, everything is just like you would expect. And one thing I want to note is that although these point particles are obviously living in a space-time manifold, these space-time coordinates are very conspicuously absent in the Hamiltonian formulation. There are no space-time coordinates there. It's just phase space, abstract phase space. But these positions, these space-time coordinates do appear, for example, in the values that the position operator, the position observables take. So these are functions from the phase space to the Euclidean three-dimensional space. And these positions take values as in ordinary space. And I've written here the dependence on the state gamma, which is an element of this state space, explicitly in order to show that there is still a distinction. This is just a value of a function, whereas this is a function living off state space. Usually, one doesn't find this dependence of the, on the argument, and simply the equation qi is equal to x, which suggests or stimulates the confusion that these two things are actually identical. But they're not. These are positions. They're dynamical variables. They depend on the state of the system. And the x and the t are just parameters that label a certain point in space-time. They're not dependent on the state of the system. They're not dynamical variables at all. And that also means that it's a confusion to think that space-time coordinates get quantized in quantum theory. That's not the case. The dynamical variables get quantized, but they and only they have that fate. And so you see, I hope, that there is an important distinction here with what von Neumann said, who said that space-time, or the spatial coordinates get represented by an operator in quantum mechanics. That's not right. The coordinates just remain coordinates. It's the positions of the particles that do get represented by an operator. But there's an essential distinction between the coordinates and the positions. Now, given that fact, that spatial coordinates nor time coordinates are dynamical observables, one might try to see whether that can be changed. And there is a well-known way of trying to treat time as an additional dynamical variable. In fact, I learned that this approach was already tried by Lagrange himself, obviously in a Lagrangian formulation, not a Hamiltonian one. It was also tried many times in later works, also by Dirac. What you do in that case is simply add time to the other dynamical observables, construct a newer, larger phase space in which that time and its canonical conjugate momenta appear as coordinates in the phase space. You also construct a new Hamiltonian that depends on these variables. And it is possible to do that in a way to recover the old equations of motion. However, it turns out that in this new formalism, the canonical momentum conjugate to time just happens to be the old Hamiltonian. In a sense, that is pleasing, of course, if you want to have time and Hamiltonian as conjugate observed or dynamical variables. But it also poses a severe problem if you look a little bit further, because it means that this variable is just a function of the other variables. In other words, this whole collection of variables here are no longer independent. It means that you end up with a Hamiltonian formulation with a constraint, as is nowadays, of course, well known in quantum gravity. But that means that there are lots and lots of problems in quantizing such a system. And it's not very attractive to pursue this road in general for such a simple case as just particle physics, classical particle physics. Besides that, taking this route doesn't necessarily get you any closer to relativity theory. As you might see from a simple consideration, the desire from relativity theory is to put positions and times on the same footing so that you can group them into a four factor. But in this case, you know, there are as many positions as there are particles in the system, but you only end up with one single time. So you don't have enough objects to treat all these positions and make them into four factors. And similarly, there's only one Hamiltonian, and you can't construct four factors out of momentum and energy in general. The only case in which this can be done is if you consider a single particle system or a system consisting of independent particles, in which case the total Hamiltonian just becomes the sum of single particle Hamiltonians. So for a general system, this doesn't give you a theory that requires these demands from relativity. So let's look at another option within the usual formulation of Hamiltonian mechanics. You might say, well, okay, I have all these position and momentum observables. Let's try to see if I can find an observable that is capable of measuring time in the sense of keeping step with the external time of my coordinate system. And that can be done. And this was, of course, well known to Heisenberg. This is basically a problem that was studied extensively in Born's book on atomic physics. What you do is you consider what is called a multiply periodic system, which in essence is the classical model of an atom or solar system or what have you. It's basically just a system of n particles with a bounded phase space. And then, in general, there is a canonical transformation from these canonical variables to so-called action and angle variables, which I have written down here. It's a canonical transformation. That means that the Hamiltonian, the Poisson brackets take the same form in the new variables. And what is more, there are very simple solutions to the equations of motion because all the action variables remain constant over time, whereas the angles increase linearly with time over a period of 2 pi, depending on the frequency, which in turn depends on these angles. But since these are constant, the frequencies are also constant. Now, that is a very simple solution. So you have variables that increase linearly with time, just like you would for the hands of a clock. And therefore, they're called clock variables. Some people also call them internal time. And note the important distinction with the previous case. There might be many such clock variables, as I just indicated. There's no limit on that. It's not like the previous case where we are stuck with one time observable. There are as many clocks as you want in any given system. But all these variables are, of course, dynamical variables. And there is no difficulty, in principle, with quantizing such a system. And the simplest case is that of the rigid rotator, in which we have only one angle and one action variable, which is identical with the angular momentum in this case. And they're canonically conjugate. And you have all that you might want from a clock variable. And of course, this is not exactly the energy, because it has an unbounded spectrum. So you don't run into trouble with the Pauli-Alcock theorem. And so in a sense, this is the most ideal case you can come up with for time or clock variable. This doesn't mean, by the way, that the standard formulation of an uncertainty relation is valid in spite of this commutator and in spite of what I've written down here. That's actually due to the fact that commutators for unbounded observables are tricky things. This object is only defined on the subset of Hilbert space, whereas this object is defined on the entire Hilbert space. So the identity has to be taken with a grain of salt. And it turns out that although this is true wherever the commutator is defined, there are states, in particular the eigenstates of angular momentum, which are outside that domain and therefore are not bound or restricted by this uncertainty relation. Now, that's a little bit of a technical problem, because in spite of the fact that this relation fails, it is nevertheless true that a quantitative version of the uncertainty relation holds, namely, whenever the uncertainty in angular momentum goes to zero, then the probability distribution over all these values of the angle must become uniform so that the system is rotationally invariant. And also, the converse statements hold that whenever you superimposed whenever you take a pure eigenstate of an angle variable, then the spectrum of the angular momentum, the probability distribution over the various values of the angular momentum must become uniform over Z, whatever that means, of course, because there's some subtle requirements about convergence here, because obviously probability distribution over all the integers, well, there is no uniform probability distribution over all the integers. But you can imagine it becoming more and more spread out and more uniform. So, keeping aside this technical problem of writing down a standard uncertainty relation, you can get almost everything you want for this particular simple example. So it's a good candidate. The angle of a rigid rotator is a good candidate for a clock observable. There are other constructions in the literature that differ from this in more or less technical details. For example, one can take a case where the angular momentum or a Hamiltonian, one can consider a harmonic oscillator with an upper bound on the energy. In that case, the energy, of course, is bounded from below and above. So we are in the regime of the Pauli Alcock theorem. But then you can construct states which are orthogonal, not for all times, but for a discrete series of values of times. This construction had already been given by Wigner and Salicker in the 1950s. And in a sense, it's a sort of digital clock because it only measures time accurately at distinct n values in the period of 2 pi. But these number of exact coincidences can be increased by taking n larger and larger. And so in the limit, it approaches a more and more accurate clock variable. There's a third class of attempts dealing with a time of arrival. You may consider a situation where, say, a particle is moving through space-time, and you might want to know at which time it arrives at a given region. Roderick has already mentioned that problem. Again, there are lots of technical problems here to consider, which you would actually already expect from classical theory, because it's not the case that every single system and every single particle must arrive at a particular location. It can simply be moving in the wrong direction. Or if it does arrive at a particular region, then it might also arrive there more than once, so that you might get a multi-valued observable. So there are lots of technical details to deal with to exclude such cases. These times of arrival operators or observables are usually not operators, but POVMs. And also, they are in general not defined on the entire Hilbert space. And I won't go into all that technical detail. But to sum up, to some extent, there are various ways in which you can construct dynamical observables in a Hamiltonian system, which are good enough up to certain approximations and qualifications, good to function as clock variables. And since there are dynamical variables, it is no problem in principle to quantize those classical observables. But now I want to consider the third option of the three options I announced. And that is to ignore the problem of having a time observable. Why not try to work with the space-time coordinates, and in particular the time coordinates, as it is? and try to find a relation that you could meaningfully interpret as an uncertainty relation for time and energy. Well, there's a very simple approach to do that. And I'm assuming here, for simplicity, that the space-time is homogeneous and that the system is isolated so that the translations, either in space or time, form a symmetry group. And as is well known, that group of translations then takes the form of an exponent of the Hamiltonian, since these translations are generated by the Hamiltonian. Now, from that result alone, it is possible to derive a nice relation that says that the time it takes for the system to evolve in such a way that the evolved system does not overlap very much with the original state. So it's the time you need in order for the state to evolve to something which is not close to the original state. That time is inversely proportional to the uncertainty in the Hamiltonian times the value that you just imposed as being not equal to one. And in a sense, I would argue that this is a meaningful uncertainty relation, precisely because of what I just said. It means that in order for a system, if the Hamiltonian is, if the uncertainty in the Hamiltonian is very small, for example, that means that in order to get a state which is appreciably different from the original state, you have to evolve it over a very long time, which is just what you would expect. And that relation is actually very powerful if you take on board certain considerations from statistical theory that Philip Goyal has been talking about yesterday. It turns out that from purely classical considerations, when you ask the problem, ask the question, how good can I distinguish two probability distributions over the same set of outcomes? That question leads you to introduce a certain metric on the space of all probability distributions. It's the Fisher-Rao metric. And you can apply the same thing, of course, to quantum states, because for every two quantum states, I can find associated probability distributions if I consider a proposal of a certain observable to be measured on these states. I can calculate the Fisher-Rao metric for that case. And finally, I can consider taking an optimum over all possible observables that can be used to distinguish these two states. If you do that, you get a metric in Hilbert space, which is just the usual metric. And in fact, you can integrate that metric to obtain a distance between two states. And that distance is just the angle between the two corresponding vectors. Why do I say that this gains, that the previous relation becomes much stronger if you do that? Well, you can use some standard results in statistics, which is basically a classical Kramer-Rao inequality that says that there is a bound on the accuracy of any estimator that you might use to estimate a certain parameter. So in our case, when we are dealing with a family of states which are all translations of each other, so I'm considering this family of states for various values of tau, and suppose I want to estimate that parameter tau. using any quantum observable you like, which might be a self-adjoint operator or a P of M. It doesn't really matter for this situation. We just suppose that this is the family of states, that for all members of that state family, the observable scales, or the expectation value scales linearly with that parameter tau. And then, well, by integrating that Kramer-Rao inequality, you get an upper bound for that very same inner product, whereas the previous relation gave a lower bound for that inner product. And combining the two, you get the following chain of inequalities. So here is a expression depending on tau and the uncertainty in the Hamiltonian. And here is an expression in tau and the uncertainty of this general time-like observable or any operator that could be used to estimate the parameter tau whatsoever. And since tau appears in all of these expressions, you can take a Taylor expansion taking tau to take an infinitesimal value, and then you immediately get this relation, which is thus the Heisenberg version of a time energy uncertainty relation. As long as, just supposing that there is such an observable. If there is no observable like that, then you won't have this result, but you could still use that previous inequality that I started out with, well, which is just the left-hand side of this expression. So in a sense, this angle between states in Hilbert space just measures the distinguishability of psi and a translated version of psi. And by the very meaning of the word indistinguishability in classical statistics, that also implies an upper bound on the accuracy of all conceivable estimators of that parameter. And so I think this is a very nice and general and strong formulation of an uncertainty relation. It doesn't rely on the existence of time observables. It just says that if there are such observables, which may be P of VMs or any of the other constructions I've mentioned before, then I will have that relation. But if you can't find such observables, well, there is still this relation, which implies all these uncertainty relations. Having gone through the motions for a class of time translations of a given state, you can obviously do the same thing for spatial translations. And in that case, you can also write down a similar overlap expression. Consider the statistical distance between a state and its translated space state, and you will get an uncertainty relation in a similar form, but with a total momentum appearing on one side. And then, of course, for any observable that is capable of estimating the parameter of the shift family, like a position operator, you will also have an uncertainty relation for that. And notice that, again, I don't need to assume the existence of a position operator, which is nice in a sense, because we know that for some relativistic systems, like, for example, a photon, even the existence of a position operator in that case, with commuting components, becomes questionable. But you don't need that. You can just use it when it's there. But you don't need to assume their existence before you write down the uncertainty relation. OK, I'm How am I doing with time? 30 minutes. 30. Okay, that's, well, then I can just go over my conclusions here. Well, the first thing I want to emphasize really here is that the way that people present the problem of time in quantum mechanics, especially in this quotation from von Neumann, is often sometimes confused. And the confusion seems to be that people think that spatial coordinates and positions of particles are one and the same thing. They're not. They take the same values, of course, but they're conceptually quite distinct concepts. Position is a dynamical variable that depends on the state of the system. It's something that you can measure, but you will have to use a particle detector in order to measure the position of a particle. For a spatial coordinate, you don't need a particle detector. You just need a ruler, and you can read off the value of a space coordinate, and you can use an external clock to read off the value of a time coordinate. They don't depend on the dynamical system that you're trying to study. And so there's also no reason to think that these should be represented by operators or observables in the quantum theory. Moreover, I've been trying to say that special relativity doesn't impose any compelling reason for us to replace time by an observable. The only condition that a requirement that relativity seems to impose on a theory is that the spatial coordinates get treated on the same way and the same footing as the temporal coordinate. But that can be done just by leaving both of them to have the status they already have, namely as parameters of this underlying space-time manifold. I'm not talking here about general relativity, of course. Special relativity doesn't impel us to replace time by an observable. And that is just what I've tried to show you in the previous few transparencies. You can take space-time coordinates to be just what they are, C numbers, parameters, and still formulate a meaningful version of a time uncertainty relation. In which case, you don't need to worry about canonical commutation relations, and therefore also not about the existence of operators for time. And, well, I just want to mention also that this route for keeping space coordinates and time coordinates just as labels of a underlying space-time manifold is, of course, also the approach taken in quantum field theory, where you don't try to quantize the x coordinates. And so, intrinsically, there's no problem with relativity, special relativity, in these formulations that I've just shown you. And then finally, well, I cannot emphasize that too much. If you consider this conceptual structure of the statistical geometry, the statistical distance, that is actually completely separate from quantum mechanics. Actually, it was developed in its crude form by Fisher even before there was quantum theory. You will be able to recover all the formulations of Heisenberg uncertainty relations in the case that there are time observables. And then finally, well, I want to return to the papers that Jan Hilkevoort wrote on the subject, which I've been heavily using in my talk, and present them to you in the hope that you might be interested. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jos. Questions, Brody first. I'm Roderick Tomulka. The hypothesis that you had in your theorem, the condition for defining what counts as a time observable, this kind of covariance property under shifts. I was wondering about the observable that corresponds to the measurement when a detector clicks. That observable, I think it does not satisfy your criterion. Could you have a similar theorem for the uncertainty in the statistics of the time when the detector clicks?
I'm not quite sure if I understand your question. When you talked about conditions, you mean the conditions in the Pauli-Alcock theorem?
No, in your theorem.
In my theorem?
Yes.
This one?
Exactly. So for the observable that corresponds to the time when the detector clicks, I think it does not satisfy this condition.
Oh, I see. The unbiasedness condition.
Pardon?
This unbiasedness condition.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you can generalize from that. In fact, there is a slightly stronger result that does not impose that condition. It's been derived by Gordon Fleming in 2001, in which case you get something like I think it's average here, and I think it is. I'm not quite sure if I have everything right. I'm just quoting my heart. This is Gotenger's. So it's something like that. And the distinction between what I wrote down above is mainly that if that unbiasedness condition would be fulfilled, then this would just be the time lapse tau. So I could replace it. But if it's not fulfilled, then, well, you still have this formulation.
Sure. Hi, Joan Vaccaro. I'd like to talk, but I'd just like to make a comment on the, is this working?
Could you speak up?
Is this microphone? All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Just a comment. You said that that there are other formalisms for, like this time operator on finite or bounded systems, and then energy spectrum is bounded from below and bounded above.
I can't understand you.
Okay. So you mentioned that there are alternative formalisms for defining observables of the kind that you're talking about, in particular where the energy spectrum is bounded above and below.
Yeah.
And, so presumably you're talking about the Pegg-Barnett formalism.
Yes.
So the interesting thing about that formalism is that there's a limiting process that is used in the procedure, which actually builds a larger space than the Hilbert space. So it has a representation in it of the normal Hilbert space, and it's very similar to the kinds of things you do in mathematics, like in distribution theory or generalized functions, where you take inner products with very smooth functions, and then you build up this larger space of distributions. And so by their limiting process, they do a very similar thing. They take limits of inner products, and they build up something that's very big. So the kinds of the program that you're looking at here is, in a sense, mapped out already in the work that they've already done. So it's just a comment.
Everything that I've been talking about has been done already. There's nothing new in my talk. And I'm aware of these approaches that you mentioned. Well, actually, it's not it's not because out of disrespect or disregard that I didn't mention them, but there are so many of these approaches. For example, I mean, in the same spirit that you mentioned, by you know going outside of the physical Hilbert space, there have also been people who construct time observables in a similar spirit, but just by you consider a time you consider a Hamiltonian which is bounded from below, from the beginning, and then you simply add negative energy states with a constraint that these are not physical and cannot be realized by physical systems, but they are still included into a larger Hilbert space. And then, of course, on this larger Hilbert space, energy is no longer bounded from below. You can define a time operator without any problems. And then the restriction to the original Hilbert space is by postulate in this approach considered to be a good time observable. In some sense, I always find that a very cheap solution because you have to go to all these unphysical states. But I'm not questioning the mathematical rigorousness of the approach, of course.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question.
Well, I just continue to the previous statement. You know, the problem is that, of course, there is a huge amount of uncertainty relations. And of course, just by Rao Fischer. And so you can build something like a classical measurement theory, okay?
If you suppose a classical measurement theory?
Yes, you don't need quantum or something. But concerning the this uncertainty relation, it should you know be rooted in physics. And you remember what Einstein said about Minkowski's space. I mean about complex unit to put to the game. To get equivalence of time to other, I mean, to space variables. This is very important because if you look at Robertson inequality, it doesn't work for real spaces, only for complex number spaces.
One can
show it in very very simple way. So you know, still for me, still the mystery of time, and just now I remember, you know, Paul. Proved that in principle there is not operator, a time operator as such in from quantum point of view. So you know, if you look really from, and of course we look for consistent or plausible, complete theories. So this is you know nice mathematical game, but from the point of physics, it's still I think mysterious and open problem.
Okay. Well, I guess there are two responses that I want to make on your question or comment. First of all, let me emphasize as much as I can that the formulation that I have been trying to propose here relies on two theorems. One is this equation 2 over there. And that embodies physics. This can only be derived assuming the formalism of quantum theory. So it has physical contact. It's not true in a classical general probabilistic theory. On the other hand, this second theorem that relies on the Kramer-Rao inequality has no physics in it. It's just a consequence of pure probability theory. And is valid also in classical physics, mutatis mutandis, of course, and doesn't rely on quantum mechanics. So this is, in a sense, pure mathematics. But the other part, and that's the real uncertainty relation I've been trying to stress, is physical. So I'm not trying to hide the physics behind the mathematics. The second response I want to make is that you are quite right that even if you have a mathematically valid uncertainty relation for time and energy, that doesn't necessarily take away the mystery of time in quantum theory. And yes, I agree with you. It's still a very puzzling concept, and we might wonder about its consequences or how that theory got there in the first place or how it should be replaced by other theories in the future for various reasons. These are questions that I didn't consider, of course. I've been concentrating on the problem of expressing a time uncertainty relation within quantum theory and show that some of the confusions and the drawbacks that people have found for such approaches can be, put aside.
Okay, we're out of time, so let's thank Jos for his